Today's daf is daf tet zayin. We're holding right at the beginning of the parak on daf tet zayin from the base, and as Saba Josh has to say, a woman who was widowed or divorced. He omered betulana sa'atani. She says to her dead husband, you married me as a betula, which is difficult to believe. So perhaps the correct girsa is betula niseti, which is a lashon that we find when the Mishnah is in Baba Batra. Although in a moment we're going to find that her dead husband is talking to her, but we have to deal with that problem anyway. But who omer, obviously, as Rashi says, this case would have to be that it's talking about the gerusha. And in the other case we infer, of course, is referring to a case where the yitomim said, lo ki ela almananis atich. So im yesh eidim. So that question over here is, until this point, in the parak rishon we've been talking about, questions as regards her ne'emanut, where the husband doesn't know what's going on. And that is, why is she not the betula that he expected her to be? Maybe before we got married, maybe after we got married, maybe I was raped, that's your baal. Whatever the case is, we had a series of machlokas in between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua. This parak now begins with arguments where the husband says, I know, I married you as an almana, but there's nothing to discuss. So now we've moved off into a straight-out suit and counter-suit situation when it comes to the payback of the ketubah, and that's why we're beginning now a new sugya. And beautifully, the first daf will actually provide us a full review of all of the cases that we had before of the machlokas, Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua, which is a great opportunity to see how they tie in, basically, with, for the first time, problems of bori v'bori, which, of course, involve other issues, which is, why don't we look at the ketubah, or is there a standard ketubah, or whatever the case would be. So obviously over here, somehow or other, there is no ketubah. And the question is, what happened to ketubah? We're going to see later on whether or not there's always a possibility of collection, despite the fact he doesn't have the ketubah. The first thing that comes to mind, of course, is that he's got a great nego over here, if she doesn't have the ketubah, of saying, I pay the ketubah. Why isn't that a meaningful nego and changes the whole balance of power in this case? He didn't have to admit to it, never having paid anyway, and I'm just arguing about how much. That is a big problem which we'll have to get to when we complete the mission.
It could apply to the husband, but it's not to the Yorshim.
No, it could apply to the Yorshim as well if the Yorshim say, we know that it was paid, and you don't have the ketubah. Why don't you have the ketubah? I'll tell you why you don't have the ketubah. You presented it in the court for payment, and we took it back, and it was paid. That's why you don't have it, obviously. What other explanation is there? So we're going to get into those questions as well. But as you can see, we open up whole new cans of worms here and get a chance to look over the other issues of Bori Vashema, and of Migo, and of Chazoka, and of Rov, which is especially important over here, because norms, there are Rovs that are Kovea norms, and the norm is that a woman gets married as a betula. Most weddings are this way. By the way, another element over here, which is interesting, is why doesn't the Mishnah say, let's just see what day they got married on? Since we said a betula is nisit biyom revi'i. Doesn't even mention that. In an almana biyom chamishi. You see from here that the almana biyom chamishi is basically an option. If everybody wants to get married in yom revi'i, and I'm a guy that's not going to go to work, I'm retired, what was one of the cases, shakdu chachamim, or I'm happy with the bracha that was given to fish. I don't care if I'm human, right? That was the other question, was the bracha. So I'm certainly able, if I'd like, to marry Yom Ravi. And indeed, there were minhagim where everybody got married on Ravi. Although there were places, this is a very interesting historical side, like there were places where the marriage on Ravi was indeed viewed as being approved that she's a ketuvah. You'll notice there are many ketuvot that have a decorated opening word, which is always the day of the week. Right? So it's a big shiloh. Where did that come from? Because beikar, it's connected to halacha. The halacha is kovea, that the shtar of the ketuvah, all the lines should be the same, and the word shlusa, there's no ability of anybody to play around. Because if you have suddenly one line that's different, so somebody could insert a word and maybe change the meaning of the ketuvah, the amount of the ketuvah. You know, you put in pounds or euros instead of dollars. So, you know, the old days, dollars were the currency. Now she's going to take advantage of the changes. Whatever. So there's big questions as to why in the world there came to be a minute that the day of the week is decorated and put up on top of big letters. It's not that there's much that you could do with it. But anyway, it's interesting. As a sidelight, it turns out that the minute probably evolved from the fact that if it was a Yom Ravi, they would put it in big letters as an indication, this is the ketubah of the ketubah. It was a big mailah to have it. Ben already mailah. So then it became in people's mind, of course, must be the first word supposed to be beautiful and decorated. So whatever it said, they decorated. It was pretty common with minhagim. In any event, the day is not viewed as by the Mishnah as an indication of what she is, but rather, im yesh edim, sheyatzat beinuma, if we have witnesses that when she went out from her father's home to go to the chuppah, and she went out, either a hinuma, we'll see later on, is a veil, or a hinuma is a type of small myrtle decoration, like a mini chuppah above her head, virosha parua, and she had her hair down, hanging down in long, across her shoulders, in long waves, which was a minhag to do for a betulot, both of these things. So then that is sufficient raya that she was a betula and ketubata matayim. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka Omer, af chiluk klayot raya. There was also a minhag that they would give out klayot. Klayot are something like, we don't really use them anymore, but they would take grains. The trick is the closest we get to klayot maybe would be puffed wheat. No, kloyot would be a whole grain that still hadn't dried, and it was put into a roaster, a popper, that would basically keep the sugars permanently in the grain, so it was always sweet. It was given out as a treat to kids. So if they were mechalek kloyot, that was also an indication of a betula. So it was either the sweetness or the locking in of the sweetness, which says Maram is the betulot, or the additional treat, whatever it is, but this was something that was done for the marriage of a betula. That's also a raya. Umoda Rabbi Yoshua. Now, this is strange. I mean, the Mishnah immediately makes you think, wow. So in other words, we're really continuing the whole discussion that we've had until now between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua. And all of a sudden, out in the middle of the blue, Umoda Rabbi Yoshua. So even though Rabbi Yeshua argued in all of the above cases, I guess is what it means, we'll see whether that's what it's referring to. There's something in this Mishnah that we have to say about Rabbi Yeshua. Mode Rabbi Yeshua, ba'omer lecha veiro. Now, in an equivalent case, this is not the first time that we have tangentially gone off to discuss elements of Borei V'Shem HaChazaka and Migo and so on when it comes to other tainas. We spoke before about somebody said, I lent you a certain amount of money, the other guy, Shema. That was basically the opening of our sugya into non-ishut issues. Here too, Moda Rabbi Yoshua, who normally argues, and he said that in cases above, we would never believe the woman, but in a similar case, where somebody says to someone, Sadeh zor shalavicha haitaula kaftia hemena, look, this field used to belong to your dad, but I purchased it. Now, over there, since he opened the can of worms, so to speak, this is how Rashi learns. So this is a classic pesha, asar pesha hitir, which is more powerful than a normal migo, because a normal migo is a response to a reasonable suit. And once you have to respond, then already we saw that perhaps Rabbi Yeshua doesn't figure too heavily on migo. Certainly on certain kind of migos that we saw earlier, we were discussing the machlokas about whether midaberes is nivelas. Right, according to Ravasi, remember the Midaberet would have offered amigo even on Libet Rabbi Yeshua, because she could have said Loni Valti Bechlal. So Tosfos at that point, again, we've spoken about this many times, but Tosfos at that point was machalik between amigo, which she had a greater power in din than amigo that was just a psychological advantage. Over here we have a further issue, which the Gemara is going to clarify, in which a pesh al-sar, hu ha-pesh yitir, is clearly much more than a normal amigo, because nobody was suing here. This is how Rashi seems to understand it. At least it's the way the Tosfos understands Rashi. Not all the Rishonim agree. But let's take that as the simple explanation. We'll get into more later. So over here, Rabbi Yoshua admits to the fact that in such a case, Shehu Ne'eman, Shafesa Shehasar Hu HaPeshitir, this is much more than Boris or anything of the sort. If I'm the only one who brought to your attention the fact that this field used to belong to your father, then I could certainly at the same moment say, but I bought it from him. And be believed. The imyeshe deem shehi shalavit. However, if it turns out, this is even subsequently, that there are witnesses that it belonged to his father, v'u'omer lekachtia emena, and then he says, I bought it, then eino ne'eman, unless he has some kind of proof, obviously, because real estate is called real estate for that very reason. It's always in the chazaka of the last known registered owner, and you have to be able to prove that that was changed.
whether Rabbi Shua said it.
Well, we're gonna get into what the relationship is. The question over here of why he cannot taina to say what he's saying with a migu that he could have said parati is a major issue. There's a lot of different shitas, and obviously it's going to have vast implications for responses to suits in general. First of all, there's an overall issue of whether something which is a maaseh beit din, which is a ketuva, even if you don't have a shtar ketuva, is an innate chiyuv. It's called a maaseh beit din. Whether someone bichlal can taina after maaseh beit din, whether we use any of these tainas for maaseh beit din, or that puts it into it means that the state, so to speak, is suing you if it's a maaseh beit din. There's some who hold, we'll see later, as a machlokas, whether you can be toin after maaseh beit din in general. But even assuming that you could, then the question would be, according to the Ran, and he's got the simplest solution, we're talking about a case where the husband, before he died, or in the case of divorce, now admits to the fact that the ketuvah was never paid. So that's not the issue. We know that from before. The only question is over here, whether she's a betula or an almana. However, Tosfos understands that the migu to say parati, where we have witnesses to, yatsat ve'inuma, is the equivalent of a migo b'makom edim. So that the hinuma is a built-in mechanism that was part of the takana, some understand of ketuvah, that the witness to a state of betula is the equivalent of presenting a shtar of a ketuvah, or of actually having witnesses that she is a ketuvah, not just to an event, and that therefore, obviously, we don't believe migos when they come to contradict edut, and that would be the case over here. So again, question of how much this is a gilui milta bialma, which then reflects back on the ketuvah, and then you would need to have a reason why not to believe the migo b'mokam the enuma, or whether it's actually a migo b'mokam edim, or whether bechlal you can taina acher maaseh beit din with tainas such as I could have said parati. Now, later on we're going to get into the question of what happens when the woman says, I lost my ketuvah, and so on and so forth. I mean, obviously that raises a whole different other issue. I mean, if we're going to pay her back when she claims she doesn't have a ketuvah, what's going to prevent her from going to some other city, presenting her ketuvah, and says, look, I'm divorced, here's my get, and or here's a death certificate, here's my ketuvah, that obviously was never paid, or I wouldn't have it, and recollect it. Well, this again, these are issues that are going to be raised in the Gemara, but over here, clearly something must have happened to the ketuvah, or, we'll see, that there were places where they didn't insist on the writing of the ketuvah, but rather relied on the maaseh beit din to avoid the issues of losing the ketuvah in the first place, which would be a whole different thing. But we certainly know that at least the minhag of writing a ketuvah was extremely ancient, because it turns up with Yosef and Yaakov. Right? Remember when he says, bazeh, what was the bazeh? Asher natani Elohim bazeh. So Rashi, I mean, the bazeh is referring to something that he is showing that validates his marriage. Because Rashi says, there could only be a ketubah. There must have already been, at that time, a shtar that was entered into at a marriage. The question is, how much is the takana that you must write the ketubah? We know that today, if you're in a makom where the minig is, now it's universal to actually write a ketubah. The fact that you were even miyached nechosim, and she's able to take it from escrow in divorce, does not take the place, according to most Rishonim, even that of a ketubah. And at the first possible moment, you're mechuyev to write a ketubah. We only had that case, it was good enough for the first Shabbat that you're married, because it was too close to Shabbat to write the ketubah, so we relied on the fact that hitvisua mithaltali. But for the, and it's only the Rajba that says over there, so it's a raya that hitvisua is sufficient for ketubah. I would say, that's part of the takana, part of the kabod of the ishad or protection, is to actually have a shtar, despite the fact that she legally may have the same protection just from the maaseh beit din. Okay, but this we'll see again in the Gemara today. Says the Gemara, all right, so you're telling me that the only reason that he is now not believed to say that you are an almana is the ika edim, because we have the witnesses that she went out with this inuma, and therefore clearly was a betula. Haleka edim ba'al beheman. Boy, this is quite a switch, because here you're saying, if you can't prove the otherwise, we believe the husband. And the whole last parak, it sounded like the Bernstein Bears. I mean, we're never believing the husband for anything, right? It's always, she's that man, as according to Rabbi Gamliel. And it's just Rabbi Yoshua who says, lo mi pia anu choy. So, I mean, what happened over here? All of a sudden, we're ignoring Rabbi Gamliel Shita. I mean, every Mishnah was talking about Rabbi Gamliel. Are we telling us now that this parak all of a sudden is not stumbling to look at Rabbi Gamliel? So now we've opened a parak with a stam mishnah. Forget about Rabbi Gamliel. Shita, we don't believe husbands anymore. I mean, it's the Rabbi Gamliel. Omar Yi Nehemna. Didn't he say all along that we trust the woman? Why not over here? Says the Gemara, what do you mean? I mean, the whole reason we started a new parak is because this is the first time that we're talking about two tainas of people who know or claim to know what they're saying. Well, I mean, obviously this is different. Rabbi Gamliel, I mean, I can't look on a Rabbi Gamliel, Hatanel, but Bori Veshema. All of the cases that we had in the previous parak were cases of Bori Veshema, where Rabbi Gamliel's entire basis of belief was essentially built on Bori Veshema, perhaps with the additional elements of Hercheskas Kashrus, or Hercheskas Betula, or Amigo, whatever, but I mean, certainly he never, ever spoke about believing her in a case where it was Bori Vabori, and over here, it's Bori Vabori. So how come Bori Vabori, lo, what makes you think that Rabbi Gamliel, I mean, I don't even understand, it's completely absurd to ask the question you asked. Says Gemara, you're right. What the heck was he thinking? I mean, it's obvious that this we're opening a whole new page here. So what does this have to do with the earlier machlokas of Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua? I mean, what was he thinking? Habari Vabariu, isn't it obvious that this is different? Well, no, because you see, we just need to clarify one point here. There certainly would be grounds to think, and we've never really raised this issue before. We've spoken about Migo, we've spoken about Chazaka, and we've spoken about Bori Veshema, but we didn't speak about the assumptions that a rov creates. And a rov also should be taken into consideration. It very often is. Let's say in a case where we have a child curses a father. I mean, do we act on that and base it if we give him out to our... Absolutely. Why can't the kid say, excuse me? This idiot, my father, obviously, my mother slept with somebody else. I've nothing in common with this guy. He's off his rocker. Happens all the time. So why can't he, Taina, that there's no proof that he's my father? And so the only reason that he can't say that is because the rov bi'ilot acharabal, even if she did have an affair, it's so usual to have most of the potential for conception coming from the guy who's with her all the time, that we rely on that to define the reality. So I might have thought over here, we also have a presumptive rov. The presumptive rov is, most women who get married are betulot. It's rare that you hear the ketuvah where they mumble and they don't say the amount, right? Which is what's done where you have that kind of situation. So therefore, maybe that would be the equivalent of the relationship of a Bori Veshema, because we're going to back the woman with a stronger bori, since her brirut on this issue is backed by the rov. So kivan derov nashim betulot nisot ki bori v'shema dani. Maybe that's the point. You know what? Vachinami mistavra. The truth is that now there's a big machlokas how to learn this. Let's learn it first like Rashi. Vachinami mistavra. What you just said that Rabbi Gamliel is meida in this case that the Baal is believed and we're not suddenly switching to Rabbi Yoshua. Is, and my proof is, Midiktani, Umode Rabbi Yoshua. Explain to me the last part of the Mishnah, where all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we start talking about Rabbi Yehuda being Moda on some tangent about a case of Rabbi Yoshua being Moda in a case of where somebody says, Peshasra, Peshahitir, this field belonged to your father, and so on. Moda to who? Why are we suddenly talking about cases of Moda? We weren't even thinking about anything. Look, I mean, if you want to tell me that the Mishnah has basically opened with a dramatic hodah of Rabbi Gamliel, even though it doesn't say umoda Rabbi Gamliel, but that's because the opening case is a continuation of the cases of Ketubah that we've been talking about, and it's very striking. And of course, that's the first thing that we noticed in the Gemara. Hey, wait. What happened to Rabbi Gamliel? That's very striking. So we came about an understanding, well, okay, that's the point of the Mishnah. That the same Rabbi Gamliel who until now went through case after case after case believing her, all of a sudden doesn't say boo. So that's a dramatic hodah on the part of Rabbi Gamliel, correct? So then, okay, then Shapir. It makes sense that at the end of the Mishnah, when we're talking about a tangential issue, so I can't just open it up. I need to say the words moda, I mean, because we're not talking about a ketubah, we're talking about something way out of left field, but it makes sense at least that I should say, you know, being as I've spoken about this new case where Gamaliel is taking the part of Rabbi Yeshua, I want you to know that there are cases where Rabbi Yeshua would also follow the did of Rabbi Gamaliel and treat a Nigel with the same respect that Rabbi Gamaliel did. So then the Mishnah would at least make sense all around. But if you're going to tell me, now, like, that actually the first part of the Mishnah was also Rabbi Yeshua, and that we're not talking about over here of a case where Rabbi Gamaliel is Moda. He's not saying, no, I was only arguing about Rabbi Shema, but in this case, I'm Moda, I would argue on you here. So then why is it saying that Rabbi Yeshua? So then, if Rabbi Gamaliel is not talking about Moda, so Rabbi Yeshua, Laman Moda. So then what does it mean that Moda Rabbi Gamaliel, who's he talking to? Who exactly is he addressing? So if Rabbi Gamaliel said, I agree to you, so I could say, fine. You know, Rabbi Yeshua says, I agree to you. But where all of a sudden is he referring to? To which the Gemara gives the obvious answer. What makes you think that Rabbi Yeshua has to be speaking in a closed system in this parak to this Mishnah? Why can't Rabbi Yeshua simply be continuing on with what he said in the previous parak? So, me, Sabbat, Rabbi Yeshua, I pirkin kai. You think that Rabbi Yeshua was necessarily referring to a whole new page in this parak, and it has to be explained why he would say Moda if we never had an argument? Did we so quickly forget the bitter series of arguments between Rabbi Yeshua and Gamaliel just 3 pages ago? Maybe he's referring to those things. Actually, did you think he's referring to the Migu of over here? He's actually going on the Migu of Pirkin Kama. So Amigo Koi. Now the problem is, the words Amigo Koi is very problematic the way Rashi's learning. Because whether we learn that Rabbi Yeshua is agreeing to Rabbi Gamaliel in this parak, and Rabbi Gamaliel did indeed agree, or whether we learn he's now being moda to Rabbi Gamaliel in the previous parak, they're always talking about Migo. So what do you mean? Did you think he's referring to this parak? About what? About the difference between a Migo. I mean, no, he's referring to a Migo. That's what we're just talking about, he's referring to a Migo. So this is the weak link in Rashi's pshat. Because that word simply does not belong here. Since no matter what he's talking about, Rich, he's talking about saying that the Migu of Peshas or Peshahitir is more powerful than the Migus that I was talking about in the previous parak. That's got to be what he's saying according to Rashi anyway. So when we say over here, no, actually he was referring to Migu and he's referring back to the first parak. Doesn't really make much sense. Vapirkin Kamakoi. Okay, but let's continue learning now for a moment like Rashi. We'll go through that. This is a great, again, the Gemara operates on various levels. So by presenting this little diak in the Mishnah, we now have an excuse to go over every single case of the Machlokas from Gamaliel and Rabbi Yeshua, to review them, to see what the elements were in terms of the additional power of Migo that Rabbi Gamaliel may have been relying on in the previous parak, and the type of Migos that Rabbi Yeshua did not rely on in the previous parak. And this is a great opportunity to put it all together with the new Mishnah of Eibori Vabori Taina. So those of you who may have missed Rosh Hashanah and didn't remember Rabbi Gamaliel, now's your chance. Says the Gemara Ahe. Okay, you're telling me he's going back at the first parak. Which Mishnah in the first parak is he contrasting a Migu that he didn't like with a Peshas or a Peshahiter in the case of the man who says this field used to belong to your father, that he does like? Let's go through the cases. Was it the case, and we're going to go from the most far-fetched, no, it couldn't be this case, to gradually approach the case that it would be, right? We want to make sure that we dispose of the elements of Migu from the clearest to the most subtle. Okay, so obviously the case where Migu would be rather far-fetched is where she is pregnant. Now, it's pretty hard for her to say, I got pregnant without being nivelet. That's a very weak Migu. So, Haitami Uberet. So, she's pregnant. And we ask her. This was one of the Mishnahis we had in last week. Yomrula Mati Voshil Uber Zen. She says, look, the guy who got me pregnant is, from the top. He's an Ish Ploni Vekoinu. So, Rabbi Gamaliel, Rabbi Eliezer, Omrim Ne'amenet. In that case, Rabbi Yeshua Omer Lomi Pia Anuchayim. Her mouth is not the source of truth and life in this world. What's the Migo over there? Hare kresa ben shinel. She's got a stomach big enough to get between her teeth. How is she going to deny that? So that's not the case that we would say there's a meaning. All right, let's take the next case down. Ela aha. How about the other Mishnah? Ra'ua midaberet in echad. We see her midaberet. Of course, we had a machlok is what that meant, but we'll talk about that in a moment. And she's talking to somebody, or alone with somebody, or sleeping with somebody, as the case may be. The omrala mativo shall izer. We went, look, lady, we got to know whether you're kosher for the kahuna. Oh, man, this guy, yeah, we did have some intimate moments, but he's a great guy. He's a ishploni, he's a kohen. Not only would he not possibly me for the kahuna, he made me doubly kosher for the kahuna. So, and Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Eliezer again say, nay, a minute. Rabbi Yoshua again says, her mouth is not the source of life. So what's the migu over there? Now, of course, there may be a migu. If midaberet only means we see them alone, and not that they actually slept together, so then there's a migu. So heinichel is Ze'iri. According to Ze'iri, who learned that the meaning of the word midaberet is only that they were alone, and it no way implies that we're convinced or know that they actually were intimate with each other, so then there's a migu. She simply could have said, nasty people. All we were doing was going over my tax returns, right? So she could have said that. Instead, she says, yes, it was great, but he's a good guy. So that's, she has an ego to say, lo nivalti, vika amra nivalti. So she should be believed. Okay. So maybe, referring back to that case, Rabbi Yoshua would say, okay, I don't think that's much of a migu, because she's got to respond. We'll see what the difference is. But this is a great migu. Well, but that's only true according to Ze'iri. How about according to Rav Asi? Now remember, we showed that Rav Asi was wrong from the Braita afterwards, and that there were clearly two different cases. However, despite the fact that we saw that he was wrong, it's essential to explain what it was that allowed us even the possibility of considering that it might have meant a case of Nivalti, because Minaberet would have been believed amigo, because he must have been able to explain the Mishnah about Rabbi Yoshua. So there's clearly another interpretation in which murder Rabbi Yoshua. What's the interpretation? I'll leave it to Rabbi Yos. Okay? Even though we don't need it, la halacha, because we know that he's wrong. Sorry. What's the interpretation? I'll leave it to Rabbi Yos. So, any chalaziri, that's fine. El Ravasi, darin maimi da beret nivelet. I mean, what's she going to say? We know that she was nivelet. So, my mika ego, ika, where is there a migo? Okay. So then let's review another Mishnah, in which there does seem to be a migo. He omeret mukat etz ani. Hu omer lo, kela drusat ishat. Now again, it's a Bari Vishem argument. She is claiming that I'm a mukat etz, and remember that it's not clear what that means. There were two shitot as to what they were fighting over. Were they fighting over 200 versus 100, or 100 versus nothing? Okay? That, of course, is going to make a difference to the migo question, as we'll see in a moment. But let's let that hang for a second. That's why this is a great chazara, because we're getting in all of the approaches that we had in the previous parak, all within a couple of lines. So we have now Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer saying, in that case, she's a minute to say that she's a mukates. And Rabbi Yoshua once again says, her mouth is not the font of life. So what exactly is the migo in that case? Now, if we learn, as Rabbi Elazar learns, Ishlem el Rabbi Elazar, who learns that the machlokes was about mana v'lo klum. So the question is that she is claiming a mana. He's claiming you get nothing. Because we're going according to the Rabbanan who say that a mukat eitz only gets a mana. Then she did have a better title. Her better title was, she could have said, mukat eitz adi tachtecha. It's true you didn't find any betulim. That wasn't because anybody slept with me. That was because I was a mukat eitz, and it was already after we got married. So it's your tough luck. Nistachta sadecha. And therefore, she could have had matayim. Vitla matayim. Instead, she says, look, you're right, you know, it was before, but I at least get a mana. So, and over there, she's saying vika amra. Instead of saying that, she's saying meikara. Now, I admit that I was a mukat eitz before, the letla elamana, and so over there, fine. We could say mehemna, and that would be amigo. And nonetheless, he's going to argue, so that would explain why it says I'm moida. This amigo is better. Why? We'll see. But according to Rabbi Yochanan, who understood that the machlokas between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua in that case was b'matayim v'mana, that if she says mukat eitz, even if it was before, she still gets 200 because it was going on leave of the Rebbe Meir. Ooh, ooh. So what better taina could she possibly have said? I mean, she's basically blasted the best of her tainas. She said the thing that gets her 200. She couldn't get more than 200. So what better taina would there be? So why would Rebbe Yehoshua be saying, well, I don't like that migul, but I do like this migul? There was no migul. Maybe that's why Rebbe Yehoshua was arguing. Here there is a migul. So according to Rebbe Yochanan, who says he's been a taina mana, where is the migul that he's being loaded to? Okay, so let's review the fourth case that they argued on. Ella Aha. And it's a brilliant organization here, right? Ella Aha. Hanoseyet ha'isha v'lo matza la betuli. He omert misher astani ne'nasti v'nistachfa sadeh. So over here she admits that there were no betulim, but she says she was raped. And he says, but she was raped after already the kedushin. Therefore, I don't lose anything. It's your bad luck. And he says, well, maybe it was from before. So Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Eliezer, omrim ne'emenet, Rabbi Yehoshua, omer lo mipi anochoi. Now over there, there is a migo. The migo is that she could have said, not that I was raped, which is nasty, and also my pasuler for the kuhuna, but instead she says, she could have said, I was a mukat eitz tachtecha. If she would have said I was a mukat eitz, it's true, it wouldn't have made any financial difference, but loka pasal nafsha mikuhuna. I mean, it's true she's not married to a kohen right now, but you know, as the Gemara in Brachos points out, woman's always got her eyes on the future. You never know, this guy may keel over, and the next husband might be a Kohen. She doesn't want to close off her options.
She's looking down, her eyes up.
That's it. Abigail. So, why say a taina that passes her from a future Kohen when she could have said something better? So that's an indication that she's telling the truth. Nonetheless, that migo is insufficient for Rabbi Yehoshua there to say that I accept what she's saying, and only Rabbi Gamliel says that she's ne'emenet. So v'ka'ona ne'enasti, the kaposa nafsham mikuna, and that's why mishumachi kama Rabbi Gamliel de mehemna. So over there we have a bori versus a shema with a migu that supports the bori. V'ka'ona Rabbi Yehoshua le Rabbi Gamliel, and then the meaning of the mishnah here in this parak, moda Rabbi Yehoshua, would be that despite the fact that I argued with you about that case, where there was a migo which she could have kept herself okay for the kahuna, I'm moda in the case of a pesh asar, hu a pesh yitir. And that would be the case where Mukama Rabbi Yehoshua and Gamliel, look, I admit that a pesh asar, a pesh yitir migo is good, but I do not agree with your migo in the previous parak. Bahu migdahatam palignaluch, I don't like that migo. Hey, I mean, Mishle, I migo, I migo. I mean, come on. They're both migos. I mean, either you agree that we examine the possible taina that she could have had, and that gives her further ne'emanut, or you don't. Why is it better here? Well, I mean, it's better. There's a big difference. Ma'ashan, I migo, ma'ai migo. There's a big difference. Ha'cha ein shor shachut lefanecha. Look, in the case over here, where the guy is coming to say, it was your father's field. There is no shor that has been slaughtered in front of you that you're going to have to explain. Who told you to open up your fat mouth? If you want to open your mouth, we'll believe you. Nobody demanded of you to say that this field was the father. It was nothing I needed to respond to, that I have to explain, how did this shor get shechted? But over here, he's saying, why are there no betulim? Now, that's got to be explained. So she's got to come up with an explanation. Now, once she's got to come up with an explanation, this is all Rashi's pshat. I thought we were going to discuss alternatives in a moment. The explanation that she's got to come up with, says Rabbi Yehoshua, she may be a pretty sneaky kind of lady. And maybe she thinks that the very fact that she's not giving it her best shot will impress us with her honesty. So we'll believe her. Maybe that's the point. Maybe the migu is the very reason why we should not trust her. I don't know. But over here, you didn't have to mention it, now, did you? So since you mentioned it, there I agree. Nobody's forcing you to come up with any explanations. Over there, it's a good migu. Apesha asar apesha yitir. About the field. Yeah. Okay. Now, as I say, this entire approach on two levels. was Rashi's approach. Now, let's go back and talk about... Yes, sir.
When they say the Devera, why is that assumed to be secluded? Is that going to be for this reason?
Yes, we brought a raya from a pasuk in Mishle, Hakala u'machata pia, v'omeret lo pa'alti aven, that we do use the mouth and its movements as a remez for sexual activity. So that was the Gemara earlier. Gemara said, why are you talking about Medaber?
Why would she couldn't her time away, she'd pass up to Kohen?
Because she was a woman who was bizana, but honest, but that passes over Kuna. Even though it's an anusa. Takas Bali. Correct. So now, let us begin. There were two major issues here. Tosfos was learning that according to Rashi, the meaning of Apesh Hasar, Apesh Yitir, is nobody asked you to bring it up. Tosfos says that is not true. Because, and the truth is, other Rishonim say Rashi did not mean to say that it's only worse because nobody told you to bring it up. The point of Apesh Hasar, Apesh Yitir, says Tosfos, is that if you start with a response to a suit which is based only on what somebody says, that's the equivalent of a pesha asar pesha yitir. If you want to respond, well, yes, it's true, it was your father's, where there was absolutely no need to do so, that is also included in a pesha asar pesha yitir. In which case, the shor shachut lefanecha is not to distinguish between who asked you to explain. It's a little bit more graphic than that. So when it comes to the field, there is no body.
But so shuffled by the field would be Adam to come and say.
That's right, exactly. So Tosfos learns that the point of here of Shor Shochut Lefanecha is, look, not having betulim is a physical issue that needs to be addressed. It's as if there's a shor here that was shechted, and we're asking you, and how did that happen? How did something happen is something you have to explain. The question of whether a person has a taina, which you can simply ignore because he's saying something, nobody asked you to respond in this way at all. You could have said, what are you talking about? It was your father's. Did you show me the deed? Did you bring me proof? Why am I supposed to even listen to you? That is also enough to say, pesha asar pesha yitir. There is no body, basically, which is a legal principle in civil law as well. Yeah, huh? Habeas corpus, exactly. There's no body, there's no shor shochut lefanecha. So, the other issue, which was different between Rashi and Tosfos, was the question of Hachinami Mistavra. We said that the Hachinami Mistavra was going back, according to Rashi, it's very mistaber to learn that in fact Rabbi Gamliel was being meida in this case, as you said, and that the meida was referring back to what it was at the beginning of the Mishnah, to which the Gemara in the end says, well, maybe it's referring back to the previous parak. Now, there's nothing wrong with that except for the word migo, because no matter how you learn it, the way Rashi is learning, it was always a function of migo that he was addressing. But I agree that this is a migo. Therefore, the Re explains that the Hachinami Mistavra is not going back as to whether it's like a Rabbi Gamliel, it's referring to what we were just talking about, which is the question of whether it's Bari V'Bari or Bari V'Shema. So we said, the reason that I asked the question, what to do, I'll leave it to Rabbi Gamliel, is because I felt that the very fact that Rov Nashim get married as Betulot turned this into the equivalent of a Bari V'Shema, because her position is so much more powerful than his. Comes along the Gemara to say, you're right, Achinami Mistavra, that's not a far-fetched issue. That indeed is supported by the Mishnah itself, that the Rov makes it similar to a Bari V'Shema. Because if not, and it's not coming to tell me what we think over here, so then, that means that Rabbi Gamliel, you'd be saying, Bichlal has nothing to do with the Reisha. See, if it's a Bori Vishema, and nonetheless Rabbi Gamliel is saying, I agree, right? Normally, when it comes to Bori Vishema, I say, let's believe her. So over here, if my position is a big Chiddush, that despite the fact that this is a Bori Vishema, logically, because of the road, nonetheless I say, let us not trust her, let's trust him. Then that means that I am being moda. So then Rabbi Yoshua could turn around and say, well, sportsmanship on both sides, I'm moda too, about this case. That has nothing to do with Migu. Then it has to do with the question of the Rov. Is this a Bari V'Shema, or is it a Bari V'Bari? But if you're telling me the way you originally responded, what, are you off your rocker? What does this have to do with the Machlokes, Rabbi Yamliel, and Rabbi Yoshua? This is a case of a Bari V'Bari. So then why would Rabbi Yeshua, in a mission in which there's no machlokas of Rabbi Gamliel Rabbi Yeshua, all of a sudden start talking about being Maida? Maida to what? You see, it's a beautiful pshat. To which the Gemara responds, no. It's the Migu. What did I say? Dude? It's the Migu, dude. So going back now to the other parak, we're not talking about the issues that were raised in this Mishnah. And we don't have to justify the use of the words mode. That's very, very cute. Beautiful. And it flows in the Gemara much better than Rashi. Hakinami Mistaver, that indeed there really is a robe that supports it to turn it into a Bori Vashem. That's nice. Okay? Isn't that sweet?
Mm-hmm.
I like that smile on your face, Rich. It wouldn't be the smile of I'd rather be sailing, would it? What me worry? All right. Yes, indeed. The blessings of ADD. The blessings of ADD.
How come the Gemara, regarding the earlier mission about the various the case of Mishnah, where the Gemara mission, where her taina was, excuse me, where he taina Nasser Nomanzer, how come the Gemara there did not cropping up the issue of Rov?
Rov Kshere Metzah, Rov Sula Metzah? We did bring that up. Yes, we did bring that up. That was Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, but perhaps we'll wait until afterwards. It's a little bit too detailed for the daf. But we did bring up Rov earlier. Okay, let's talk about that afterwards, okay? All right. So now we have our Mishnah, our explanation of the Mishnah, the difference between this Migu and other Migos, and two possibilities into how it is that Rabbi Yeshua is being Moda, whether he's talking directly to Rabbi Gamliel, whether he's talking to his own Shitot in the previous parak. All of this fits in, no matter how we learn it, it works out nice. Question is this. I don't understand, now that you've said that Rov Nashim Arbetulot Nisot, and you actually wanted to use that as a way of turning this into a Bori Vashema, so then why the heck do we need Adis? Why don't we actually follow the Rove? I mean, now the mission doesn't make sense. You're telling me most women get married as a bit too low. Okay, so then straight off the bat, we should say, unless a guy can show that she was an almana, then he's going to have to pay, because the Rove, of course, this only goes according to Rav, who is also named Alpi Rove, for the belief that Holchin, even B'dinei Momon, is Achara Rove. Not everybody agrees with that. But as Tosi says, okay, but I'll leave it to Rav in any event. That we would go, even when it comes to the Motzi Momon, with the Rov, okay? Then why can't we use the fact that the norm is to get married as a Betula? So let him prove that she wasn't a Betula. Let's start with that instead of requiring witnesses. How do you explain that? Omer Ravina, I'll tell you. Look, I mean, you're right. Ikala Meima Rov Nashim Betulot Nisa. But there's also a Miud, obviously, that marry as Almanot, right? Now, the problem is that in a normal case, when a woman gets married as a betula, basically all the kids are running through town. It's a big deal. They come down to the kotel. They take pictures. People decorate the cars. Everybody's chasing them. It's a big deal. So this is something that is going to be remembered. And the guy's not going to be able to say, I married an almana. What are you talking about, almana? I remember the wedding. Everybody in town remembers the wedding. What almana? So the very fact that he's able to come along and say, I married an almana, now we got to start looking around for witnesses, is very suspicious. And therefore, kol anisei betula yesh lo kol. When a woman marries as a betula, people know about it. In this case, obviously, people don't know about it because we need to look around and find witnesses about it. V'zeh hoil v'ein lo kol itra lo ruba. Something is very suspicious, so we can no longer rely on the rov. Wait, what did you just say? If you're telling me that is, you're defining it. Every betula has a kol. Okay, no kol, no betula. Witnesses, liars. You said everybody. You learn how to speak carefully. You said everybody. So then, okay, so kiyatu edi my hobby, then what good are the witnesses? They're going against the facts. You're telling me every betula has a kol. If we couldn't find anybody who knows about it except these two weirdos who claim to remember that she went out with Enuma, and nobody else seems to recall anything about her being a betula. So obviously these guys are liars, right? So they're sahavi shakri ninu. They're lying witnesses. Okay. Sorry. Boy, the pedantic people around here. Ela Amar Ravina, Rov Ani Zei Betula. What I mean is, most women who get married as a betula have a kol. Okay? V'zu ho'il ve'en la kol. Itra la ruba. So her rov is now contrasted to the rov of the betulot yesh la kol, which she doesn't have. So we're now basically left with a suffix. Since we're left with a suffix, we now need to have indication as to what happened. These witnesses come along, they're not liars, and they're telling us what happened and that she was a betula.
Obviously, it has to do with a matter of time, like they call it.
Let me tell you something. When it comes to time, you're living in a modern era in which people are not really involved in what goes on around them. It used to be that time was a very small element of what went on in life. Now, I'll tell you a little story that brought this home to me. This was actually 45 years ago. I was sitting in Tzfat in the Arishul. And there was this old man that used to sit there all day. I used to avoid talking to people, otherwise they would sit and talk to you all day long. But this guy looked absolutely horrific one day, and I hadn't seen him for a while. So I felt terrible as an old man. So I'd go over and I asked him, "What? You know, something wrong? You okay?" So he says to me very pointedly, he says to me, "Do you know what it's like for 50 years to put your hand on the other side of the bed and there's a woman there, and then she's gone? So you just lost his wife." It was like very moving. You know, to see an old guy in Svat say something that really tore at me. Okay, so we get to speaking. So he says, "What's your name?" So I tell him my name. So he says, "Oh, I know a guy by that name. He actually got married here in Svat." I said, "Yeah, that was my grandfather." "Oh, really?" he says. "I had a brach under the chuppah. Would you like me to show you where it is they got married?" I said, "I'd love to." So he takes me into the chatzir, Mamish, almost a quarter. Now it is a quarter, and it's completely wrecked. But at the time, the house was still standing, and there's a porch outside. He says, "See that porch? That's where we made the chuppah. It was Erev Shabbos, and then we walked around town, which was the minig, and you made the chuppah Erev Shabbos, and we had the Shabbos Siddur, which was the Siddur of the Chasana." And anyway, meanwhile, people in the chutzah hear us talking, and they start shouting, "The balabaya take it, come in!" And they're all running out. "The roof is leaking." "And we've got the roof is leaking. You've been living here for 50 years without paying any rent." "That doesn't matter." Wouldn't you know it? It's nice that happened to her. Not. About a month afterwards, all of the heirs got letters from the Iriyah warning them that they have to repair this sort of a... It's amazing.
But this old man's family.
No, the people that heard us talking suddenly became aware of the fact that there are descendants of the owners who are responsible to take care of the old house.
And that would be...
there were people from the previous generations. But anyway, that's the timelessness of it. I mean, it's like that happened yesterday as far as he was concerned. You know, like, yeah, it looks a little bit, you know, a little bit worse for 100 years, but it's still fine. Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. People couldn't afford a wedding meal. But they had to put out money for Shabbos meals anyway. So if the wedding was right before Shabbos, they could be yotzei the Shabbos meal and the wedding meal with one meal, so it was that they could afford.
Throw another chicken in the pot kind of thing?
Yeah. Anyway, but so as far as 50 years go by, 100 years go by, what difference does it make? It's basically the morning. But I had another mice in Svat also, which is incredible. This happened only about 30 years ago. I was visiting the home. Not the home. Remember Motel Tzfat? This guy owned Motel Tzfat. He was the first mayor of Tzfat after the Kuma Medina. Okay, so I'm in there, and his wife comes in. And, just to make conversation, I said, "You know, my family comes from Tzfat." She says, "Oh, really? What's the name?" I say, "Loberbaum." "No kidding, Loberbaum. They lived on our street." I remember one of the Loberbaum girls went as a very young girl and came back a few years later carrying a boy on her shoulders who was wearing knickerbockers, which in those days was outrageous in Svat. I say, "That girl was my grandmother, and that boy was my father, and I saw the picture." And she was remembering like it was yesterday. So amazing. So in places like that, no time goes by. only in Svat, that's true. Okay, sorry for taking the time. That was cute things to remember.
Yeah.
All right, I'm sorry. Im yesh edim shiyatzta. Im yesh edim shiyatzta b'inuma. Leichus dima mafke edim b'hai beidina v'gavya v'adam afkele l'ktuva b'hai beidina v'gavya b'. So now we've got a problem. If she's collecting with the enuma, then why can't she collect 100 times? There's no way for us. There's no ketubah. What happened to the ketubah? Why does she have to present the ketubah? Omer be'avu zotomer kotvim shofer. I mean, obviously, saying the ketubah is lost, right? So this proves that you can force a person to accept a receipt. And he can't say, I don't want to accept a receipt. Then the onus is going to be on me to take care of my receipt. And if 10 years from now you claim again, I'm going to have to present the receipt, which maybe got lost in between. That's why you had a shtar in the first place, so that you would return it to me if I would pay. And then I wouldn't have to worry about this. Since we don't say that, it's clear from here that we can, in fact, force a person to accept a receipt and say, look, you protect yourself to make sure that you're not sued again. Rav Papa Omar, Rav Papa says, not true. We will never force a person to accept the shofar, because he could say, why should I have to take care of it? If you have got a shtar, either you present the shtar or you don't get anything. So how do we explain the Mishnah? Why does the Mishnah allow her to collect on the basis of the Eidim? Because the only way to understand it, says Rav Papa, is that we're talking about b'makom she'in kotvin ketubah. This is a location where there is no ketubah. So that people over here rely on the Maisa Bezdin, and that's what happened here.
It's the only place we collect would be the same basin in that same town, which they
are. No. We're going to talk about it. The Ikanamati La Abraita. Now, others learn that it's referring to this machlokas of Rabbi Avu and Rabbi Papa is referring to the following Braita. Ibda ktuvata, a woman who loses her ktuba. Hitmina ktuvata, or she does what most women do. I put it away in a safe place, which, as you know, means that when the wrecking crew comes to build the next generation of homes, it may turn up. So she put it away in a safe place, which means it's gone forever. Or nisrafak tuvata, or her ktuva was burned, and we're going to see what exactly the difference is in these cases. Rakdu lefaneh, if we have witnesses, that they were dancing in front of her as they do for a betula. Or sichaku lefaneh, or haviru lefaneh kos shel bisura. Now later on, we're going to discuss what these minhagim were. But they obviously had various minhagim of how to dance, how what type of games you play in front of her, a special kos, whatever that means, that was passed around. Shigemar will talk about. Or the actual linen with the blood of betulim. Im yeshla idim bechad miyelo, ktuvata matayim. So now, that's what the Braita said. It was there that we had this machlokas. We asked the question, how can you collect on the basis of a lost ktuvah? Lechishdul mamafka edim b'hai beitin v'gavya, v'odar mafka l'ktuvata b'hai beitin v'gavya ba. What's to prevent her from collecting now with the witnesses, claiming the ktuvah was lost, or where she put it away, maybe she actually found it. Miracles do happen. So she may find it 5 years from now. Come and collect with it. And then how are we going to prevent her from collecting twice? On Rabbi Avu, and it was here, according to this Lashon, it was here that Rabbi Avu says, well, you see from this Braita, kotvim shover, because otherwise, if we can't force a guy to accept the receipt, why would we force him to pay the ketubah? Rav Papa says, this only makes sense if it's a makom she'in kotvim ketubah. We're talking about a place where the minig is not to write a ketubah. What do you mean a minig is not to write a ketubah? It says, there was a ketubah, but the ketubah was lost. V'ha ibda ketubah ta'katani. So how can you say it's talking about a place where there was no ketuvah? No. He wrote her a ketuvah so that it would be even better for her. But it wasn't necessary mitzad adin. So the katav la il. Okay, fine. So then we're back where we started from. So he wrote her a ketuvah. So now we've got the problems. If he wrote her a ketuvah, I ask you, what do we do about the fact that sof sof, mafkela, she in the end can turn out, take this ketuvah, and gangiva, and collect it? Well, no, says Rav Papa. We're talking about a case where we have witnesses that the ketubah is gone forever. Because when it says it was lost, doesn't mean it was lost. It means it was lost to the flames. Well, no, that's the last case. It says nisrafa. Not to mention, what are you going to do with the fact that it says she hid it? Itmina. And over there, definitely it wasn't lost to the flames. And over there, we certainly have a chashash that she's going to find it. So itmina ma'ikala mima. Not to mention, what would be even the point of mentioning a case of ibda at all? Tosfos says, even if you want to kvetch and say ibda means that it's nisrafar permanently, then it's the same anyway. And why mention two cases? No, it says Rapapa. You don't know how to read this correctly. The way to read it is like this. Ibda, as far as we're concerned, is Hitmina. And therefore, forget about it. You can't collect it because you're going to find it. And we don't let you collect at all. So the way to read the Braita is Ibda Ktuvata, Hitmina Ktuvata. On the other hand, Nisrafa Ktuvata, if we have witnesses that the Ktuva was actually burned, then we don't have a chashash that she's going to come and collect with it again. Then let's look at the riots. That's how I understand it, says Rav Papa, that it's two separate cases. So, Koli Daki, Tvina Befanino Dami, Veloya Avinan La, unless we have Eidim that say, Nisrafak Tuvata. Now, Manda Matina Braita, the ones who learned that Rav Papa was willing to argue, even on the Braita. So, okay, Koshkin on the Mishnah, that's the way he would have explained it. But Manda Matina Amatnitin, okay, over there you could say, you bring a riot that goes from Shover, and so on. What are you going to do about the Braita? The Braita, to come to this crazy creation, the Braita, maybe from over there, Enoch Inami, Rav Papa would have been stuck. He wouldn't have been willing to give this pshat. It would certainly seem from the Braita that Kotfim Shomer, because it's talking about that there was a Ketubah. Maybe Rav Papa wouldn't be willing to go all the way and say, no, it's talking about that there wasn't a Ketubah, just he wrote the Ketubah, and we lost the Ketubah, and it was burned the Ketubah, and so on. But Lemaisa, I mean, what do we do? Why can't you do this innumerable times? You tell me we don't have a ketubah. Fine, you don't have a ketubah. So you come to Bez and you say the ketubah is gone. Witnesses, the ketubah is gone. Whatever the case is. Therefore, I'm collecting. So now she goes to another town, brings a get, and says the same thing. I don't get it. Yeah. The get with witnesses that she was saying, what's the problem? She can do this innumerable times. So v'leikish dimma mafki aydeh innuma b'hai Bez in the Gavya. No. That's for sure. That b'mokum de lo efshar, in a case where there is no alternative. In other words, Rav Papa is saying like this. If you live in an area where they don't write a ketubah, then obviously they have to institute modes of collection. Well, what's the mode of collection if you don't have a shtar? There's only one mode. That's the shover. In other words, the very fact that we don't write the shtar means obviously that you're forced to take a shover. All I'm talking about is if there's an alternative of a shtar, then you could say, now listen here, the whole reason you got the shtar is so that I don't need the shover. So you can't have it both ways. You lost the shtar. That's your problem, not my problem. That's what Rav Papa would say. Okay, gentlemen.